Hey, folks, as we approach another critical election, a wave of concern washes over America. Recent studies reveal that an astonishing 56% of our fellow citizens report feelings of anxiety or dread about the upcoming presidential election. That's why I stand with AMAC. AMAC is more than a senior discount organization. During these challenging times, they fight for common sense and hope that our nation returns to traditional American values. Visit amac.us/justnews today to seize an exclusive election year special, a four-year AMAC membership for just $30. That's right, you heard me right, 4 years for 30 bucks. As an AMAC member, you're not only enjoying money-saving benefits, but also the AMAC magazine, free Social Security and Medicare advice, a trusted voice in Washington, and a community of like-minded patriots who love this great nation. Take advantage of this election year special, 4 years for $30, and be part of the solution over the next 4 years. By becoming an AMAC member, you're strengthening a movement dedicated to preserving the principles we hold dear in this great country. Join now at amac.us/justnews. That's amac.us/justnews. Hello, America, and welcome to a Friday edition of John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News, where today, yes, we made it through a busy, sometimes frustrating week, right? Those images from Afghanistan still trouble so many of us, and there are so many Americans still left on the ground, so many Afghan friends, good people, who did help the United States during its 20-year war that are stranded, that our hearts and prayers and thoughts are with them until every one of them is safe. But we've got a really, really great show for you today. I'm really excited about it. Dr. Weifeng Zhang is joining us. He is an international expert on China, and particularly what he's created is an index. It's very exciting, where he studies all the rhetoric of the communist government officials at every aspect of Chinese communications, and then creates a projection of what might be coming over the horizon for China. What are China's next most important moves going to be? He uses artificial intelligence. He gathers this information up. He makes projections, and he has some pretty bold projections about where communist Beijing is going in relationship to Taiwan, in relationship to Afghanistan and all those rare earth minerals we were talking about. Really a fascinating thing. We're going to have a great deep dive today on China and why the current posture of Beijing and its communist government matters to the future security of our great country. So we're going to have that in a few minutes. Now, before we get there, I wanted to point out a couple of stories today. We continue to find out who and what types of Americans are left behind in Afghanistan. And my good colleague Sophie Mann confirmed that there are nearly 30 Sacramento area students that weren't evacuated or still trapped there. Very important to keep an eye on that. Secondly, overnight, there was a British commander, the man who oversaw British forces in Afghanistan for a long time. He had some pretty sharp words, Colonel Richard Kemp did, for President Biden and his withdrawal and the way the withdrawal was done from Afghanistan. I'm just going to read a few comments of what Richard Kemp told Breitbart News last night. It basically ceded a huge amount of authority and power and influence in the world from the West to the authoritarian states of Iran and North Korea, particularly China and Russia. Now, he called Biden's exit the greatest foreign affairs and military catastrophe since World War II, without a doubt. He said it was far worse than the Vietnam fiasco, and certainly worse than 9/11, which may be the result of intelligence failure and possibly could have been prevented. But it was a surprise, he said, and the Afghan exit was a, quote, self-inflicted wound, the result of a deliberate policy decision against the advice of his generals. It's a real blow for American prestige, said Colonel Kemp. Pretty remarkable words that rattled through the entire national security establishment globally. Richard Kemp's a very respected figure, and he and many other British officials have been very harsh in their assessment of the president. You can see that frustration boiling over even to some in other governments as well. I hope you got a chance to see our special last night on Real America's Voice. If not, you can see it online at any point today. Just check it out at justthenews.com on the TV tab. That's the place to find it. And then I want to point out one more important thing, a little bit of politics. It's about policy in Congress. Many Americans that I've talked to, particularly Republicans, very concerned about the $3.5 trillion spending package that the House has already approved, that Joe Biden is behind, and that is now pending in the Senate. Well, Joe Manchin, keep in mind, the Senate is 50-50 with Kamala Harris as the deciding vote, so that means Democrats have just a one-vote margin, right? Just a one-vote margin. If they don't have that one vote, they can't pass things. Well, Joe Manchin gave a speech Wednesday night in West Virginia to the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce, and he said, I want to put a pause button, hit the pause button, to stop the $3.5 trillion liberal agenda spending bill from being passed in Washington. I'm just going to read you a couple of the things he said. You can see the YouTube video. We posted it there for you. I would ask my colleagues and all of the Senate to hit the pause button on the $3.5 trillion, Manchin said. Let's sit back. Let's see what happens. We have so much on our plate. We really have an awful lot. I think that would be more prudent, wise thing to do. There are just too many things the country is facing, like runaway inflation, he said, and he warned. And I know he said of his own Democratic caucus, they're going to go nuts right now because of what I'm saying. But I'm thinking of it from the standpoint of where we are as a nation today. What an interesting thing to say. A member of Congress who actually is concerned about the nation before his party. This is a major wrinkle in the Democrats' plan. It is roiling Washington, at least the Democratic side. The Republicans are quite happy, to be honest with you. But Joe Manchin has become one of the most important deal makers in Washington. This could change. You always got to be careful, right? But right now, this seems as though it is going to be a roadblock to the progress that the Democrats were trying to get on their liberal agenda. And the question now is, will the progressives, the AOCs, the squad, people like that, will they turn on Joe Manchin? What an interesting dynamic to have to watch here in Washington. All right, folks, those are the big headlines I wanted you to pay attention to. I hope everything is going well. And what I would say to you is we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Dr. Zhang will be here. You're definitely going to want to hear what he has to say. An important conversation about China. Right after these commercial messages. Folks, if you owe back taxes, fair warning, you're not going to like this. The IRS is mailing millions of pay-up letters. Millions, I say. Then it's up to the 20,000 new IRS enforcement agents to find you. Why the IRS targets you and not millionaires? Well, because millionaires have tax lawyers. You don't. You'll pay up. Plus interest and penalties. You need Tax Network USA, and you need them now. Tax Network USA has brilliant war room strategies to solve your IRS problems quickly and in your favor. Like a preferred direct line to the IRS, they know which agents to deal with and who to avoid. It's not all bad news for you because Tax Network USA learned of a special limited time IRS offer. They're willing to waive $1 billion in penalties if you qualify. So schedule your free confidential consultation to see if you qualify for this limited time IRS penalty canceling offer. To do so, call 1-800-245-6000. That's 1-800-245-6000 or visit tnusa.com/justnews. That's tnusa.com/justnews. All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. And today, I know we spent a lot of time in Afghanistan the last week for all the right reasons, but I want to keep our eye on another always emerging threat, and that is China. We always need to be cognizant of what's going on there. And today I am so pleased to be joined by a real expert, somebody whose work has been really instrumental in creating horizon tools that American policymakers and intelligence analysts and others can use. His name is Weifeng Zhang. He's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, just down the street here in Washington, a renowned China scholar. And one of the things that I like most about his work is that he created a thing called the Policy Change Index. And we're going to ask Dr. Zhang to describe what that is, because it's one of the great horizon watching tools we have in our databases and in our arsenal. Dr. Zhang, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
It is an honor to have you. This Policy Change Index, those of us who have covered Washington have monitored it. It is such an important tool because it uses machine learning to analyze basically all the propaganda going on in China and give us some predictions of where the communist government, the Communist Party in China may be going. Tell us what inspired you to create it and how it has helped all of us to stay on top of what's going on in China.
So I actually had this idea from over 10 years ago, but I couldn't do it when I first had the idea, which is when I first left mainland China. I was born and raised in China until I finished college. But then when I first left mainland China and went to Hong Kong for my master's degree, and by the way, Hong Kong was relatively more free back then.
Sure.
Very different story.
Very different, yeah.
Yeah, but what really gave me like the shock of my life was to realize that I did not know, you know, innocent students and residents of Beijing, they actually died in the Tiananmen Square massacre. Because growing up, I was told by Chinese propaganda it was, you know, a minor disturbance, and so nothing bad really happened. And so that's when I really realized after I left mainland, the propaganda environment, that propaganda is really effective in controlling information, changing people's mind, actually. And that turned out to be really important because before the Chinese government changes its policy, it would typically try to manipulate people's mind, manipulate popular opinion in preparation for the new policy. So that's when it gave me the idea, but because it's so effective in manipulating public opinion, it must be indicative of the government's actions. But it's only really after I came to the United States and started to, you know, learn all these techniques about machine learning that I realized it's actually now nowadays much easier to do, to just write some programs to analyze Chinese propaganda, and then from there to make inference about, because what they're saying this now, what they would be doing next. So that's what's underlying the policy change index.
Wow, it's such an important tool. So now that we have this, and it uses machine learning too, which is very cool because all of our brain power plus machine learning can give us a great amplification of data, particularly when there's large loads of it. Given what you're now analyzing, what are some of the trend lines that you think are on the horizon? Where is China going with places like Taiwan, what the continued crackdown in Hong Kong? What are some of the predictive models showing for how the Chinese Communist government may act over the next 3-6 months, a year?
So based on what we have seen so far, I think there's really an underappreciated aspect of the trends that is actually going on in China, but we don't emphasize it enough, which is that the turn away from pro-market reforms in China really happened before President Xi Jinping. It happened in the previous, under the previous administration, President Hu Jintao's term.
Right.
And that's what we saw from the policy change index, because back in 2004, the Chinese propaganda had been preparing for this kind of left turn in policy leading up to what later became the harmonious society of the President Hu Jintao. And the idea, basically, whatever the Chinese government says, it's what it doesn't have, right? So when it says harmonious society, it means the society is not harmonious. And then the solution they were pushing out back then was to say, you know, market reform is probably not that good. You know, state-owned enterprises, they could serve much larger purposes. And so all these trends going away from the economic reform path initiated by Deng Xiaoping was actually starting almost 20 years ago now.
Isn't that amazing?
Absolutely. And so what we saw, however, we do need to recognize that all this change has been much more dramatic under President Xi Jinping. So that's what really caught people's mind outside of China. But we need to recognize that it started much earlier on. And so that's going to be very important in terms of understanding what China is moving toward in the next steps. Because under President Xi Jinping in the last few years, it sort of drastically enhanced the emphasis on state-owned enterprises and how important it is for China to be a leader on the global stage, which is why we are seeing all these aggressive foreign policy instruments like the Belt and Road Initiatives.
Right.
And so all this is on the horizon, and I think it will be creating more concerns for the global economy than it is already now.
And describe what those concerns are long term. Obviously, China wants to supplant the United States as both the military and economic superpower of the world. They clearly would like to have their currency as the world currency. Most of the West has, for the last 25 or 30 years, been addicted to the opportunity to have markets in China, right? Cheap labor sending goods over here and a large 1 billion plus audience being able to be sold to American products. why now, after all that 25, 30 year kind of belief that China was going to be a good trading partner, are people seeing threats to the economy from the way Beijing is acting?
I think we should not have been so surprised, actually, in my view,
had we recognized
the nature of the Chinese model. Because actually, ever since China joined the WTO, coincidentally, we see, at least coincidentally, maybe intentionally, which is less, you know, we don't know as much, that China has been much more actively pursuing bad policies, in, at least in our from our perspective, including, you know, the much more heavy use of forced labor camps, including what's happening in Xinjiang now, and also, you know, stealing intellectual property from foreign companies. And so there are all these, and also, like I said, emphasizing the state sector rather than the private sector. And so all of these is actually giving China an edge in the trade liberalization. Because when we think about trade, right, the typical model would be to say each country would be producing what they can produce the best, right? That's
yeah,
the competitive advantage. But
you can
also look at it from an institutional level, which is that all these bad policies, they actually have been very good for China's manufacturing sector. And so there's also the reason or an incentive for the Chinese authority to enhance those policies, just like a country would enhance or focus on certain goods. And so I think that's a trend that's coming, and we have not really noticed it until the very recent years. But all these are coming up, and it's important because in the Chinese government's perspective, that's something that the Chinese leaders hope would be an equal to what we consider the better capitalist model. So that's what, when you said, John, that China has the ambition to overtake the U.S., I think the ambition lies just as much in the institutional level than in the pure material economic level.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And as we look at this, what levers do policymakers have? Was the approach of Donald Trump in the last year or so of his administration of limiting access to American capital markets, is that a good solution? And what are some of the solutions, as someone who has studied this and is analyzing China's every move, what are some of the tools America can have to protect our interests, our capitalism, our supremacy in the world?
That's a great question, John, because what we have witnessed in the past 4 years under former President Trump's administration was actually trying the opposite of what I call the romantic engagement with China.
Mm-hmm.
So the romantic engagement has been going on for 20 years since China joined the WTO. Right? So, but the problem with the opposite, though, I think under President Trump was we have seen a lot of blunt force measures like cross-the-board tariffs on Chinese goods. The hope back then when President Trump started this was that that would force China to change its model or abandon all these bad policies
right.
that we just discussed. It actually did not work, right? Because if you think about all these U.S.-China official meetings in the past recent months, including what's happening in Alaska, and also the Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, when she went to Tianjin with the Chinese officials, the demands made by the Chinese side did not actually include asking the U.S. to take up those tariffs. You know, that means that that's not really hurting them. What they demanded was to, for example, release the daughter of the Huawei founder from in Canada. So,
right.
so they were asking what hurts, and obviously tariffs did not hurt. That brought us to now the dilemma for the U.S. because you are in this economic engagement so deep, and now you know a divorce is so painful. So how can you find a sort of a bliss point or the sweet spot in between the two extremes? I think that's the biggest challenge for U.S. policymakers.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And on this very show, about a year ago, we had the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who said the single biggest mistake he made in his public policy career was assuming that once we opened up capitalism to America, that it would react the way that many of the Soviet Union republics did. And he said that was wrong. The Chinese are patient, and they were never going to assimilate our model. Their goal is to assimilate our markets to their most important interests. And he had some regret. And one of those things that he said is, you know, we had more leverage when we had most favored nation trading status reviewed every year and approved by Congress. Can you see a scenario where America could fall back to that if the frustration or the aggression of China becomes too much?
I don't think that's very feasible. The rule, for example, governing WTO was that you would need the consent from all the other countries except China to actually kick China out.
That's right.
So once China's in, it's in. So yeah. I think that we have a certain, at least certain degree, no doubt, path dependency in terms of what instruments we can use to deal with the threats coming up from China, because we can't go back to the past. It's not possible anymore.
Such an important dynamic. So I want to pivot in a second to the forced labor camps and the Uyghurs and what is really one of the tremendous human rights abuses in the world right now. And it just doesn't get the celebrity of prior human rights abuses, right? Whether they were, you know, in Rwanda, I mean, we remember all of the different television Hollywood campaigns that took a look at things going back to the killing fields in Cambodia. But before we turn to that, I just want to ask one other question. If you were sitting across from President Biden right now and advising him on how to navigate this relationship with China, what would that advice be right now?
So I think the first thing I would say is to take off the tariffs immediately, because they are hurting U.S. consumers. They're hurting U.S. businesses every single day without achieving any goals. And those were in place, have been in place under this new administration, which is, so they're basically keeping President Trump's policy intact and under the pretense or the excuse of reviewing it. So after 8 months in office now, they are still reviewing it, almost 8 months. And so I think that's not effective, because it's hurting ourselves without achieving our goals.
Yep.
And the second I would suggest was actually to go back to create the transparency using government policies to try to provide transparency into exactly what ways our values, our liberal democratic values in our society, are compromised by Chinese influence. And then you address those issues instead of using blunt force measures that are not going to do anything.
On the question of Taiwan, all the machine learning that you're doing, all the over-the-horizon analysis, what is Communist China's intent with Beijing in the next 3 to 6 months?
Interesting you ask that, because that's one of the predictions we made over the past few years. So a year ago, shortly after COVID subsided in mainland China, at least for a while,
right,
what we detected in propaganda was China's unusual emphasis on the military power, which is something very rare we haven't seen for many years, that China all of a sudden put something relatively minor about China's military power on a very prominent place in the official newspaper, the mouthpiece. And so what that suggests actually is that some sort of a military actions might be on the horizon. And of course, back then we didn't know whether it would be, you know, the Taiwan Strait or, you know, China-Indian border. But we made that prediction just a few months before. You may remember right after the election, 2020 election, China started to fly all these jet fighters across Taiwan Strait in, as a show of force. So that actually just happened after, not long after we made the prediction. And so now you mentioned Afghanistan at the beginning of your show. I think that's a very relevant point, because after the chaotic withdrawal, in my view, and people, it frustrates people on many different levels. But one thing that now is being questioned is the U.S. commitment in and elsewhere overseas. Would the U.S. abandon Taiwan just like it did Afghanistan should China attack the island? And so I think that's actually a valid concern, because credibility matters in foreign affairs, right? It's just the thought that it might abandon Taiwan would give China a lot of confidence. And so I think it's, what worries me now is whether the U.S. could actually reaffirm its commitment to allies so that we would not get into this catastrophic conflict with China in the Taiwan Strait.
Wow. What an important dynamic to be watching. I'd like to flip to the Uyghurs and the forced labor camps. As someone who grew up in China before coming here, obviously embraces freedom, how big a human rights issue are these camps and the treatment of the Uyghurs? And as someone who has had both perspectives, being in China, now being on this side of the ocean.
Yeah, so I think the history of forced labor in China is very long. It's just as long as the People's Republic, the regime of the People's Republic itself.
Yep.
Because one of the very early prisoners of the labor camps is actually the last emperor of China from the Qing dynasty, who was captured by the Russians, and then the Russians gave him back to Mao, and then Mao just immediately sent him to one of these camps. And so it has a long history. But like I said, though, that after China joined the WTO, the practice has been much more widespread. Just wrote a recent piece on this Cross magazine with my colleague,
yes,
Christine McDaniel, and in which we sort of documented this trend or the history and how large the scale is, because there are various estimates about how many Uyghurs are now in concentration camps, and the numbers ranges from 800,000 to as many as like 2 or 3 million even.
Wow.
And so the scale, now how much is the, how large is that scale? Because China has about 12 million Uyghurs in the population. And so if you incarcerate like 2 million of them, 3 million of them, it's equivalent to about 20 to 30% of the population.
Right.
So that's a large scale. So the problem is obviously very serious. But the challenge for the West or for all our liberal democracies around the world was that they are struggling to come up with the solution, because even just we look at the words coming out from G7 countries' official statements about Uyghur forced labor.
Right.
And what we saw was, interestingly, that ironically, that when a country sells more stuff to China, their words are softer already on Uyghur. So we are not even talking about actions, just words are already softer when you have higher economic interests in the Chinese market.
That's so interesting. You don't see a resolution or enough. Are there any levers right now that would get the Chinese to reduce it? So if I understand you correctly, too, after we got them into the WTO and we normalized trade relations, permanently normalized them, you're saying that the Uyghur labor camp population grew, right? The Chinese became more aggressive once they got what they wanted?
Yes, and there are exactly correct. So before the Uyghurs, by the way, Tibetans are also in those labor camps too,
yep,
not just the Uyghurs. And the practitioners of the what's known as Falun Gong, the religious
sure
group,
yep,
persecuted, and many of them are also in forced labor camps. The in terms of policy, though, so in principle, the U.S. authorities could request, if they suspect that some goods are made by certain factories use forced labor, they could actually request to have auditors go in to, and check on them. But the request had to be approved by the Chinese government. So what happened in the past was that it would take about 10 years for Beijing to yeah write back and say, yes, please come. And so after 10 years, everything is all
yeah, it's already changed. Yeah, right.
Absolutely. So I think the ineffectiveness of state actor or government actors in this respect. And so a possible solution Christine and I looked at in the piece was to say whether civil society could play a bigger role. For example, we have seen that, you know, the chocolate industry, for example, where it's notorious for using child labor. And some chocolate companies, they come up with some ways to sort of trace the origins of product and to try to make sure to demonstrate credibly to their consumers that it doesn't use any child labor in the supply chain.
Yeah.
So technically, it's actually possible to trace the forced labor. But the problem, of course, is that you would need every steps on the way, all the suppliers in the supply chain to actually verify that they didn't use forced labor, and that the Chinese government could actually get in the way and say that you're not allowed to participate in this program,
right,
otherwise you're out of the Chinese market. So it's hard there even.
It doesn't give us, a lot of the options aren't strong options, and it seems as though the Chinese have taken an upper hand in a lot of the positions that, in effect, our relationship with them. What will the Chinese-American relationship look like 2 years from now? How is it going to evolve over the next 2 years?
I think it depends a lot on what the U.S. side will be doing. It doesn't really depend a lot on what the Chinese government will be doing, because
right
we know pretty well what they are going
to
be.
And they're going to stick to the plan. They stick to their plan, right?
Right. So one side of the equation is all fixed. But the challenges, the variables are all on the American side, what
sure
exactly this U.S. administration is going to do. And I think it's, from that perspective, it's really concerning me, because I don't think the current administration has wrapped its head around how to approach China. And all, there are a lot of China policies left over from the previous administration. They're all under some sort of reviews by the Biden team, and they still haven't come up with anything. I actually doubt that whether they actually have an effective strategy, because why else would you need to review the previous administration policy for so long? Because, you know, last time I checked, President Biden ran against former President Trump for, you know, in the campaign, right?
So yeah, not only that, almost everything else that President Trump did, he reversed, right? He didn't, on day one, he got rid of immigration. He did, so it wasn't like they didn't have a plan for those other things. Why do you think he's cogitating and slowed down the China decision making?
I think the challenge I see is that the state level actors probably in this kind of issues is ineffective no matter how you slice the cake.
Yep.
Because when we talk about forced labor, right, when government actors, they come together and try to deal with these issues, it's not only the human rights issues that are the only thing on their mind. There are also economic concerns, legitimately, and there are other strategic concerns.
Sure.
Right? But if you look back at the Carter administration, it's actually very soft on South Africa during the apartheid regime, and precisely because of the economic concerns and all these diamonds and whatnot in South Africa that are attractive to U.S. and its allies. And right. So sometimes you turn a blind eye, and I think at this government level actors, it's in to some extent understandable. And so the problem for policymakers, I think the transparency that I refer to that's needed, for example, when it comes to forced labor, to understand exactly whether a certain good we see in Walmart is using forced labor, it doesn't really have a lot to do with government policy. I think the transparency could be provided with other technologies. And so maybe that's where the current administration is hesitating, because I just don't see that many tools in their toolbox that could be effective.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people I talked to today said. Will Taiwan still be free 2 years from now, in your judgment?
I think it depends on whether the U.S. can demonstrate the commitment to defend Taiwan. I think I actually wrote about this a couple of months ago on The Examiner.
You did?
Basically,
yeah.
Said the only path to have peace in the Taiwan Strait is actually for the U.S. to commit to defending Taiwan should China invade the island. Because China has long believed for decades now that one country cannot have two systems. It failed in Tibet, actually,
right.
Was the first experiment of some sort of one country, two system. And we know very well now that it didn't go well in Hong Kong.
Right.
And so Taiwan is a problem from the Chinese perspective because it's a free country. It has freedom, economic freedom and political freedom. And so I think it's clear that the Chinese intention over there is to reunite Taiwan. And so whether we could actually have peace in the Taiwan Strait is actually requiring a U.S. commitment to defend Taiwan. And that's the only way, I think, to maintain the status quo.
Yeah, such an important thing. We're going to find out America's willingness in light of what happened in Afghanistan, the messy exit that we clearly effectuated there. What does China do? There are really two things. First off, do our allies like Taiwan now doubt our resolve a little bit given the way we exit? And then two, does China's already large monopoly in the rare earth metals market become much larger because they'll have access to the Afghan lithium and other things? Are those two dynamics that are going to be sub-consequences from the withdrawal of Afghanistan?
So let me answer your second question first.
Sure.
There's a lot of discussions about China eyeing the rare earth mineral and other minerals in Afghanistan. I think it's possible. It's very hard to extract all these resources in Afghanistan because that country really lacks the very basic order and security and safety,
yeah.
Even, or infrastructure.
That's why the America didn't really get it developed very much in the 20 years we were there. It's just hard outside of the big cities to have any security, right?
Exactly. And now it's going to be way worse now,
yeah.
Right? Unless China actively provides security,
right?
Which I don't think China is very good at anyway. And in terms of the U.S., though, also, that we talk about the Chinese dominance in rare earth, but actually the U.S. is well on its way to regain some rare earth and mineral independence from China, because now there are a lot of companies raising to use technologies to mine those minerals in a way that's environment friendly,
yeah.
Which means that, you know, the U.S. actually has a lot of reserves. We did not mine them a lot because it damaged the environment a whole lot. So that's why we source it from elsewhere. But if there are technology, green technologies that can allow us to do that domestically, that would actually relieve the U.S. from the dependence on China.
In this situation, we find ourselves now in the sort of the last moments of the 20-year war. There's always a geopolitical analysis that goes on. And so if you're Great Britain or you're Taiwan or you're Germany or whoever, what does the alliances that we've had for so long, NATO and Taiwan particularly, how are those alliances going to morph in the aftermath of the war on terror, or certainly the war ending in Afghanistan?
I see as very likely that some countries that you for 20 years have been sort of in the middle between the U.S. and China would have to eventually pick a side.
Yep.
Because I don't think the Chinese model and the capitalist, the Western model that has been dominating are compatible. We know that China is not going to change its mind. And so at some point, I think countries in the middle, including, you know, for example, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, they are going to have to pick a side, whether you are going in for the plenty in China, meaning the trade and all this economic interest, versus security, which is enhanced the alliance with the U.S. And so I think the redrawing of the map, the world map, I think might be very likely in the next few years.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be keeping a close eye on.
There is. This is an extraordinary moment. And, you know, we've been basically in the Cold War alliance posture for maybe 50 to 60, 70 years. Obviously, there's been adjustments and movements. The war on terror created some of them. But this is a moment where realignment seems like more of a reality, and that the status quo won't be the status quo. There's going to be change. Dr. Xiong, how do people follow the good work you're doing? How do they get in touch with the Policy Change Index and see in real time the extraordinary work you're doing?
Sure. So anyone who's interested in the Policy Change Index, the best way is to go on our website. It's policychangeindex.org, where you can find everything that we do with this open source project, including you can actually download our data for your research purposes as well. And other work of mine can also be found at mercatus.org. Thank you for having me, John.
Oh, no. It was an honor. This is such an important discussion. I felt like I took away a lot from it. Really, really grateful, and I hope to get you back on soon.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, sir. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to wrap things up for the day. But first, a word from our great advertisers and sponsors. Folks, Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. Why? It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. I love the fruit flavors particularly, and it's completely improved my life and my health. This is nutrition the way nature intended. When I began taking a hard look at why I wasn't feeling good and why I felt unhealthy, why I was gaining weight, why I was losing energy, it wasn't just because I had hit my 50s. No, it was because I wasn't getting the right amount of fruit and vegetables in my diet. And listen, I'm just too busy to go to the store, clean up the vegetables, cook vegetable dinners, and make sure I hit the fruit. A Field of Greens stepped in. One scoop of powder in my drink or on my eggs in the morning, and boom, I was off and feeling better. And suddenly, I was losing weight. I was sleeping better. My metabolism went up. My blood sugar went down. My cholesterol went down, and my weight went down. And my doctor said, hey, whatever you're doing, keep it doing. You know what that is? It's Field of Greens. That's what I've been doing. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you, you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guarantee. Now, you're going to get 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping because of the incredible partnership we have here at Just the News with Brick House Nutrition, and of course, Field of Greens. All you got to do to take advantage of this offer, visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JustNews. That's promo code JustNews at fieldofgreens.com. Don't wait. Go to fieldofgreens.com today. Use the promo code JustNews for 15% off. All right, folks, welcome back for the commercial break. It is time to wrap it up. Let's go forth and have a long 3-day weekend. Yes, Labor Day weekend, a chance to celebrate all of those who work to make America work, to make America move and grow. To all the workers, you have my salute. To all the union workers, way to go. And to all of those healthcare workers and first responders, the men in blue, the firefighters, the paramedics who did so much this last 15 months to keep us alive and well in the midst of the worst global pandemic in world history. I want to thank you particularly, nurses, doctors, officers, paramedics, firefighters. We got your back because you've had our back. Thank you. Thank you. And again, thank you. We are deeply grateful for the sacrifices, the courage, the compassion that you have shown a nation in the grips of a terrible sickness. We are going to go to that weekend. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America, as he always has. You've been listening to John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News. At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.